Certainly today we've grappled with this question about the American situation and the role that the Catholic Church can play in that, in our future as a nation. And Catholic social doctrine is a very powerful tool with which to think about our public involvement. And there's really no person, I think, writing in English language, perhaps in any language, who knows more about and has thought more deeply about the tradition of Catholic social teaching than Russ Hittinger, our next speaker. He's a member of a couple of pontifical academies. The Pontifical Academy for the Study of St. Thomas? St. Thomas Aquinas and the Pontifical Academy of the Social Sciences. And he's a professor at University of Tulsa, where he teaches both classes in philosophy and law, both. And I am very fortunate to have him as a board member of the Institute on Religion and Public Life, which is the 501c3 that publishes First Things magazine. And if you have any money left over, you can always contribute it to, I'm sorry, Father. Well, without any further ado. Yeah, it's good. Without any further ado, please welcome Russ Hittinger.
Thank you, Rusty, and Religion and Public Life. Thank you to the Dominicans. Thanks to Mike Hanby, that was worth the price of admission.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really. So, the social vision of Leo XIII, he took as his pontifical shield, his coat of arms, a comet rising in the heaven with the phrase, Lumen in Caelo, a light in the sky, in the heavens. And so, Father Thomas Joseph gave me directions. You might do an Owl of Minerva, the social vision of Leo XIII. And I immediately understood that the Minervian owl is Leo XIII, not yours truly. The image of the Minervian owl comes to us in modern times from Hegel. In the preface to the Philosophy of Right, Hegel wrote, "One more word about giving instruction as to what the world ought to be. Philosophy, in any case, always comes on the scene too late to give it. When philosophy paints its gloomy picture, then a form of life has grown old. It cannot be rejuvenated by the philosopher's gloomy picture, but only understood. Only when the dusk starts to fall does the owl of Minerva fly." Unquote. I think Hegel probably meant to say that the philosopher can grasp the whole of a thing only when it's complete enough to be understood in the dusk. That is, complete enough to know it, but not so complete as to completely pass into the darkness. Wisdom in historical matters is like a swan who sings one beautiful song before it dies. This is not a perfectly apt metaphor, either for Leo XIII or for Catholic social doctrine. After all, the Leonine picture of the world spanned six pontificates. Six popes were either born or come of age during Leo's 26-year-long pontificate. Actually, John XXIII was a seminarian in Rome in 1900. So he didn't sing just one song. He wrote 110 encyclicals, if you can imagine. And beginning as a 68-year-old man, if we count all of the social encyclicals of the six subsequent popes who were formed in his manner of thinking, We're dealing with about 150 documents. So this is not an Owl of Minerva who just takes one snapshot and shuts up after that. But I do want to work with the image of the Minervian owl, because Leo really was the epitome of Catholic social doctrine as wisdom. as a kind of wisdom about social matters. One that needs to be distinguished but not separated from our more recent hermeneutic of reading the signs of the times. Reading the signs of the times belongs to Cassandra, who had the gift of prophecy. Cassandra reads the signs of the times, but it belongs to Minerva to know the difference. That is, the difference between wisdom and direct engagement in the changeable things of the city. At the beginning of the modern tradition of Catholic social doctrine, Leo said, in rerum novarum, quote, nothing is more useful than to look upon the world as it really is. And even if Leo and his successors tended to look upon the world from on high, by the way, Pius XI, who was Leo's student and successor, went so far as to say, the pontifical point of view is upon the world as from a watchtower. That's at the beginning of Casti Connubii. Even though they looked down upon the world or out upon the world, they nevertheless wanted to understand the ordinary, concrete, social, and historical world. It's better to understand the world as it really is. So, given that this is the 125th anniversary of Rerum Novarum and the 25th anniversary of Centesimus Annus, what I want to do is to situate Leo, what he understood and what he didn't understand, and then say a couple of words about John Paul II, who I think was on the whole rather Minervian. And then finally, a brief coda on Francis, who has taken the role of Cassandra. The 19th century papacy had the daunting task of responding to what Leo himself called the great conflagration. In France, the Catholic culture of vows was swiftly turned upside down. 1790, the French Revolution issued decrees prohibiting monastic vows, then criminalizing solemn vows, and in their place required all clergy to take an oath to the civil constitution of the church. 1791, marriage was made only a civil contract, and celibacy for the secular clergy was relaxed. Capped off a year later in 1792, by a decree allowing unilateral and no-fault divorce, and then a second decree abolishing the monarchy. These two decrees spelled the demise of the two great vows of the laity, husband to wife and king to the realm. And soon enough, it became clear that this revolution and deep social reforms based upon the Enlightenment was both ongoing and globalized. For his part, Pius IX played the role of Cassandra, syllabus of errors. And by the way, he was a really good Cassandra. But there's limits to what Cassandra can say. Leo, for his part, asked, how do we civilize this situation? To borrow a tag from Charles Taylor, what is our social imaginary as Catholics and our proposal for a social order rightly apprehended? What can we still work with in social matters? And how can we make a proposal that's true but not utopian? So Leo and his student, Pius XI, I'm going to sort of put these two together, pulled their teachings together on a wide map of social order according to the notion of three great or necessary societies. Leo's overriding theme was that it's in the mutual interest of the state and the church to preserve whatever helps persons to live well and happily, which is to say, societies necessary for human flourishing. Pius writes, now, there are three necessary societies distinct from one another and yet harmoniously combined by God, into which a man is born. Two, namely, the family and civil society belong to the natural order. The third, the church, to the supernatural order. So to paraphrase and revise the old Aristotelian dictum, the human person is a matrimonial and familial animal, the human person is a political animal, and the human person is an ecclesial animal. Human persons, therefore, will live well and happily, not only by inhabiting each of these societies one by one, but inhabiting a situation in which these societies have a concord among one another. So this is on display in Rerum Novarum. He begins by saying, "It's no easy matter to define the relative rights and mutual duties of the rich and the poor, of capital and labor. But there are principles." By the way, it's a mark of the Minervian. Keep a distance from the details. That is, Leo never gives policy recommendations on the condition of capital and labor. He announces principles. Now, the beginning of the principles is what we would call a moral framework. That is, the dignity of wage labor, reflecting the human person as an image bearer, capacitated to be provident for himself and for others. A person who transcends animal instinct, and who does so not just on the basis of production, but on the basis of rational foresight. And thus, the right to have as at his disposal, stable property. This case is not made on the basis of a state of nature scenario, but rather on the rights and obligations of the domestic society itself. Leo's entire argument for the right of wage labor is based on the domestic society, if you go back and read it. He continues, "Just as the symmetry of the human frame is the result of the suitable arrangement of the different parts of the body, so in a state is it ordained that by nature that these two classes should well dwell in harmony and agreement, so as to maintain the balance of the body politic. Each needs the other. Capital cannot do without labor, nor labor without capital. Mutual agreement results in the beauty of good order." So in Leo's point of view, each of these necessary societies, church, polity, and domestic society, is subsidiary to the others. The word subsidiary simply means it's of mutual help to the other. It's not just the state that's subsidiary. The role of the church is to inspire and form in the virtues, especially the virtue of religion, its baptized citizens. It's the role of the state to protect the order of justice and to protect the other societies in the commonwealth. And it's the role of the domestic society to be the first social cell based upon procreation, affection, and koinonia, shared life. Leo's toolkit was rather simple. An incredibly subtle mind, but the toolkit is simple. This is why it lasts for so long. It's sometimes called hierarchical complementarity. A society made up of different orders and therefore having relations that are truly mutual. They need each other. They exist in themselves as true societies, but they exist also for the other dignified orders. For Leo, it's not just human individuals that have dignity. There are dignified orders, beginning with the three necessary societies, all of which are instituted in one way or another by God. All of the Leonine necessary societies, for example, have the analogy of the political, because both in domestic society, in the church, and in polity, there is vested there an authority that transcends private contract. Subsidiarity and solidarity, the terms that are often used today in Catholic social doctrine, are immediately derived from this notion of hierarchical complementarity. Distinct societies necessary for human flourishing that need one another. And therefore, what was most dangerous for the working man, to use a Merle Haggard phrase, what was dangerous for the working man was that these societies were not getting along. It's really surprising in retrospect that a Thomistic interpretation of Aristotle's Politics, Book 2, worked so well. Now, radicals, anarchists, and later the totalitarians would have nothing of it. But by and large, Leo's toolkit worked pretty well for the main ruling powers, by which I mean Germany, England, the new Italian government, and the Third Republic. Yes, they quarreled over diplomacy. But they did not quarrel over the proposition that domestic society, church, and polity are the perennial features of social order. Those very powerful nation states of the late 19th century were not totalitarian. The real quarrel for Bismarck or the Third Republic or for the new Italian Republic was not whether there's a domestic society. Imagine Italians denying that one. It was not whether there is a domestic society that's crucial for flourishing, or whether there's a polity, or whether there's a religion. Most of the Protestant states still had established churches, by the way. They weren't giving up religion. The quarrel was over how these three societies need to be aligned. The nation states, by and large, insisted that the state has the first and the last word over how that concord is to be worked out. And this is why, from the time of Leo, Pope 1878, dies 1903, all the way through World War II, the most concrete fighting issue internationally for Catholic social doctrine was schools. Schools was the concrete issue. If you go back and start reading encyclicals at the time of Pius IX, and just keep on reading them into the 1960s, and you only pay attention to schools, you'll learn everything you have to learn about Leo's toolkit. In fact, the esteemed church historian Roger Aubert has called the school issue the classic battleground. For it was the school that was the locus of competition between the rights of the church, the rights of parents, and the state. When Pius XI, for example, asserted that the family is more sacred than the state, he's talking there about the problem of education in the schools, quoting the American Supreme Court's dictum that the child is not the creature of the state. Now, in the Reformation and Counter-Reformation era of the 16th century and afterwards, that launched a new era of what I'm going to call religious education, mostly catechetical for both clergy and laity. But the Leonine era witnessed a different movement. The rise of schools, formal schools. It was one of the greatest accomplishments of industrial society, was the creation of schools, and not just state schools. In fact, Leo himself approved the decrees of the Third Plenary Council of Baltimore, 1884, which launched the largest parochial school system in the history of the Catholic Church. It was created in about 35 years. The largest private school system in the history of human race, not just religious school system. So schooling was not just the preoccupation of Catholics, but it was a preoccupation of the culture at large. Families were immersed in and enveloped by formal education. No institution more deeply affected family life in modern times, or religious life. Religious life, the vowed life, was never the same. after formal education. And Leo reformed the seminaries and put a curriculum in place for the education of priests. It was Leo also who instructed the Americans that when marrying a non-Catholic, the non-Catholic was to make a formal written pledge to be a good Catholic? No. Education of the child. That goes right into the Code of Canon Law of 1917. But by and large, I can say this about Leo and his successors. They always want to protect the institutions. The notion of tossing off institutions, it would have been anarchical to them. Save the institutions, especially these three basic or necessary societies. It's interesting to me, in retrospect, that while Leo understood the global reach of certain ideologies, he gave no indication in his thought or teachings that market capitalism was already a world system. That investors in Bremen in London extended credit to cotton producers in Mississippi and India, who in turn induced, sometimes compelled laborers to work for export markets rather than for local and domestic subsistence. That there emerged global networks of banking, shipping, insurance, trading on futures. They already had derivatives back then. And the whole new industry of information, climatology, demographics, actuarial tables, methods for measuring both abstract and real property, and that in the developed nations there emerged enormously large and complex corporations capable of coordinating distinct and dispersed operating units. At the time of Leo's death, for example, U.S. Steel had assets greater than the annual revenue of the U.S. government. And this entire system, it was a system of information, production, sale, insurance, had penetrated and transformed the interiors of every continent in the world. This is the first globalism. It's market capitalism. Now, Leo certainly understood the import of protecting wage labor. And he understood the importance of an emerging category called civil society. In fact, he himself spoke of the church needing to address chiefly the conscience of the people in their various endeavors and judgments. We could call it civil society. But the Leonine Minerva, who devised a toolkit that lasts for the better part of a century and rather well, missed the most important social phenomenon of the 20th and 21st centuries. It's called market capitalism. He missed it. Now, for his part, Pius XI couldn't miss it altogether because of the Great Depression. But if you read Quadragesi Milano, issued on the 40th anniversary of Rerum Novarum in the second year of the Great Depression, is still the Leonine toolbox. He dedicates the entire encyclical to the project of, quote, the reform of institutions and the correction of morals. In fact, Pius XI uses this paradigm of the three great societies even more than Leo did. He does not treat economics for its own sake. He had other things to worry about, chiefly the dark cloud of totalitarianism. But there's one thing that these two popes did see, even if it was more in the mode of Cassandra. It concerns what they called liberalism, namely that the three necessary institutions of human flourishing might be reduced, to quote, this is Leo, reduced to the genus of commercial contracts which can be rightly revoked by the will of those who made them, unquote. So, social forms like marriage and family might be left to be determined either by the state or more likely by private contract with state sanctions, and thus become not a society with intrinsic social form, but a societas arbitraria, whose form is stipulated by private contract and then supported by the state. They issued several dire alarms about this possibility. It was sounded almost always in reference to liberal reforms of marriage and family law. But it bled around from the edges of that. Here's their Cassandrian thought. What if all three necessary societies are disincorporated from above, made simply instrumental to private lifestyle, so that a marriage or family, maybe even a polity, rather than making good on or exemplifying some perennial social form, was rather constructed, stipulated, and changed arbitrarily, as though even the church is just one among other immanent systems without transcendent grounding, not even in nature. Now, Leo himself allowed for changing political forms. Here's an Aristotelian. There's more than one legitimate political form. Rule by one, rule by few, rule by a many, or a combination of them. But marriage and church don't have plural forms. So he's willing to go with the modern constitutional changes. By the way, he never approves of democracy particularly. And by the way, he was not just being an old fart on this. I have to tell you, the word democracy or any variant of it is never used once in any of the 16 documents of Vatican II. What was being affirmed was polity as a social form absolutely necessary for human happiness. You think you're going to be happy without what polity does? You are an anarchist or a utopian of some kind. Whether it's democratic or you call it representative is another matter. The Leonine corpus of teachings, drawn out of what I'm calling a simple toolbox, has sometimes been called the Great Coherency. If you read Rerum Novarum or Libertas or Humanum Genus, you can almost predict what Pius XI is going to say. And not just Pius XI, but probably Pius XII. And even Pacem in Terris, which is sometimes taken to be the beginning of the modern reading the Signs of the Times encyclical issued spring 1963 by John XXIII. The whole thing is built around six modes of order and the mutuality and hierarchical complementarity of six modes of order, which he learned in the seminary in the 1890s when Leo was Pope. It was a great coherency. One reason can be attributed to Minerva. These popes did not understand everything, but they understood the most important things about social order, the non-negotiable things. And it was a great coherency because facts on the ground for many decades basically favor the analysis of three necessary societies and the mutuality that ought to obtain between them. Wars, the Great Depression, the ugly spectacle of totalitarianism, and the rebuilding of Europe post-1945 really did favor the incessant appeal of Catholic social doctrine regarding cooperation between these necessary societies. And it's also true that although I think these popes missed capitalism as a system, they couldn't go there. They've already condemned socialism and Bolshevism, they can't speak that way. And in some ways, they missed it. But they were let off the hook because there still existed very powerful states from the 1890s onward that were capable of taming some of the capitalist energies. In fact, the rise of the public corporation in the United States involved deep cooperation between the government and the business sector and the investment sector. GE, IBM, General Motors. What's good for General Motors is good for the country. They created company towns with careers, wages, pensions. They brought people into a community of work that were skilled, semi-skilled, and as well as professional class. So the civilizing of the competitive economic system was in a way taking care of itself. And by the way, World War II helped a lot too, because World War II destroyed capital, as Piketty points out, and therefore capital had to cooperate in the rebuilding of markets and political order. Now I get to the second Minerva, John Paul II, who really witnesses a second globalization that runs from decolonization post-World War II. The greatest period of decolonization begins in the 1950s into the mid-60s or so. Any of you who are old enough to remember that, if you collected stamps, you went crazy, because countries were going into existence and out of existence and new stamps and flags. The whole theme of development becomes important. John Paul lives through all of this. He sees it all happening. And he affirms the basic framework of three necessary societies, now called in Foytian language subjectivities, social subjectivities. He basically follows the Leonine framework with one major change. The state now becomes instrumental. And that's right in Centesimus Annus, by which he meant the subjectivity of the state is inferior to that of the nation, which has true social subjectivity for John Paul II, and inferior to that of matrimony and the family and, of course, the church. And he moved along the philosophical wall considerably in treating, under the aspect of social subjectivity, the family. He gives, in effect, the first philosophical and theological treatment of the family for its own sake in the history of the Catholic Church. I would say about Augustine, first autobiography is the first treatment in ancient literature of childhood. People didn't deal with childhood as a systematic topic once upon a time. When Leo and his successors treat the family, they're primarily treating it as a necessary institution, the flashpoint of which is either the threat of civil marriage and divorce or the problem of the schools. They're not treating the family for its own sake. J.P. II makes great strides forward on that front. And John Paul is also aware that there's a lot going on underneath the three great institutions or the three great societies. He understands that economy and civil society are very dynamic. And thus, there emerged, on the part of Catholic doctrine, two quite different definitions of the common good. On the one hand, we have the definition of the common good derived from Vatican II, which is the sum total of conditions allowing individuals and groups to pursue their fulfillment. That definition is used by Pope Benedict in Caritas in Veritatis to say it's merely instrumental and not to be loved for its own sake. It sounds like a kind of aggregation of subjectivities, which itself does not have koinonia to it. And then the traditional understanding of the common good as the union of members transcending in any kind of aggregational sum. I think this is kind of a disaster myself, but I understand why it happened. Because social reality simply became sufficiently complex that they needed two different understandings of what a common good could be. But JP2's most important Minervian wisdom had to do with what was called negative anthropology. He saw, rather than anticipated, the Cassandrian fear of Leo XIII and Pius XI. What if it all is reduced to private contract and will? In his 1976 conferences for Pope Paul VI, Wojtyła claimed that the crisis of the 20th century was not becoming, but already was, anthropological in nature. And the distinctive mark of that crisis is what Wojtyła's friend Rocco Bottiglione aptly called negative anthropology. The crisis is manifest in the ready affirmation of what man is not, combined with a deep-seated reluctance to affirm any normative anthropological content. And Wojtyła held that this is not some esoteric philosophy or ideology, so much as it is an experiential and practical option familiar to all of us. So at the Second Vatican Council, Wojtyła worked on those anthropological sections for the pastoral constitution, the church in the modern world, and especially on the section on atheism. The human being who is an atheist, he said, is persuaded of his own end, if I may so speak, of his own eschatological aloneness. Wojtyła's intervention moved drafters to distinguish between external or systematic aspects of it, and the systematic aspects of atheism, to distinguish between atheism as a political system, or even as an educational system, and atheism as an anthropological position. And Wojtyła was convinced that the exaltation of Adam through a negation of his natural and religious aspects has a mythic structure that overlaps with and subverts what sacred scripture reports about the frontier of Adam, who is resolvable neither into God nor beast. That is, Adam knows what he's not. And according to Wojtyła's reading of the situation, modern culture takes that Adamic moment, the negative moment, and universalizes it. He said, we must imagine, to understand our world, that man is an unknown being. And more than that, that man is alone and his greatness requires him to be so. Later, when he was Pope, he lectured the Roman Rota that the problems they were dealing with in matrimonial law on these tribunals wasn't just a legal issue, it was a problem of anthropology based upon a myth, an imagination, that our humanity is only proto-human, awaiting humanization through the efficacy of culture, a sphere of freedom in which a multiplicity of forms can be imparted to the proto-humanum. If you've got that kind of problem on your hands, you're in deeper territory than canon law. He kept on warning him, there was a deeper territory to this. So John Paul understood what Leo and Pius were worrying from afar about. What if the perennial social forms were so degraded as to become private constructions? So in our modern times, we can easily imagine polity, marriage, and church as merely optional. Not normative and formative institutions in which we live a life and achieve perfections over generations, so much as instruments that can be used to live a life of our own choosing. And that negative anthropology renders the three great institutions of happiness platforms for self-revision, but not for the perfection of a nature. So this institutional reform of the Leonine Minerva, which is all the way through Pius XI, they're always saying, save the institutions, save the institutions, would be in vain if underneath all of that, the most revisable form is the humanum itself. And this is what led Ratzinger to say. Catholic social doctrine is no longer just a theory of institutions, but it's become radically anthropological. I'm going to skip something. What I'm skipping is this. They still don't get the fact that capitalism is a global, market capitalism is a global system. They still don't get it. Synthesimus Onus is not good on this. In Synthesimus Onus, if you just go through in the way that Abelard would go through, the church fathers went, sic et non, and put into different categories the way that a market is described, you will find, on one hand, it's koinonia, a community of work and solidarity, society of persons, or it might be like civil society, an expanding chain of solidarity. More often, it's explained as mechanisms or a machine or mere tools, commodities, tools, instruments for utilizing resources. That's not koinonia. Or sometimes they'll simply describe economic behavior and the relations that ensue upon it as open processes, or maybe networks. My full description is for later, but I don't think they understand that a competitive market economy is not civil society. Because civil society requires modes of benevolence and solidarity, even if it's only a coffee club or a newspaper. In fact, economy cannot be put neatly and totally under the category of civil society, much less under the family. And so it's Benedict XVI who, in Caritas in Veritate, really admits he doesn't know where to put it. And this is after the financial crisis, 2008. He says, it's a multi-layered phenomenon. It has to be civilized. It seems to have aspects of all these different societies. But you're not going to find a Minervian philosophy about it in Caritas and Veritate. And the problem is made worse by the fact, not knowing just how to describe economy in a competitive global economy, under what category to put it, whether it's mere tools or whether it's some kind of a social thing. If the Marxists were wrong, they were wrong because they actually thought they could civilize it. What if it's not civilizable? Or you're going to civilize it by destroying civilization. And what makes it very difficult is that what civilizing factors existed three generations ago are very weak today. That is, states. Very few states control their own domestic economy anymore. And oftentimes when we say that the polity ought to civilize the market, make it moral, it's a basically admission. It's an admission that it's not moral, or that it's amoral, and it only becomes moral by some extrinsic addition. And in fact, in most Catholic documents, when they talk about the obligations of the state with regard to whatever this Promethean thing is we call competitive market, it's usually just ex post facto. It's the role of government to come and clean up the mess of individual liberty after it's done its destructive work, which is to say that capitalism is a social but amoral thing, which is probably not what they want to say. So, many problems of dealing with that post-2008, it doesn't fit neatly into Leo's toolbox. Enter Pope Francis. So, for Francis, he speaks of it as a world system, and that the familiar institutions of our life are empty shells of technocracy in the service of the empire of money. To my knowledge, he's the first pope to speak explicitly of international capitalism as a global system, which should have been obvious a long time ago. And whereas previous popes emphasized the importance of nation states and their moral juridical relations to one another, Francis's global system, as he understands it, leaves in suspense the agency and efficacy of the nation state because it's been suborned. He's quite explicit. The states have been suborned. Quote, the new power structures based on the techno-economic paradigm may overwhelm not only our politics, but freedom and justice. The 21st century, while maintaining systems of governance inherited from the past, is witnessing a weakening of the power of nation states, chiefly because of the economic and financial sectors being transnational. Francis is fully alive to the significance of decadent institutions. He almost always speaks of processes, movements over institutions, movements over political parties, the praxis of those who live and suffer the social consequences, direct engagement with the people rather than abstract models of standard economics or abstract models of political policy. And we've come a long way since Leo XIII's modus operandi. It's a modern operandi of moderate adjustments of the great institutions. In fact, I haven't read the current apostolic exhortation, but in Laudato Si, he never mentions Rerum Novarum. If you can imagine, it's 41,000 words. Rerum Novarum is never mentioned. In fact, it looks to me as though he has a hermeneutic of suspicion of the institutional analysis, impatient with mediating institutions, impatient with institutionally filtered opinion. Reality on the ground, more important than the ideas. Or what category you're going to put capitalism under. And all the more remarkably, his hermeneutic of suspicion begins with the church itself. Canon law and curial bureaucracy, doctrines compiled by scholars. We are dealing now, to invoke his own metaphor, with field hospitals in which the ministers are not very different than the patients, if they're different at all. And in his first apostolic exhortation, he makes all this very clear. George mentioned it. We should be in a permanent state of mission. The principal aim of these participatory processes should not be ecclesiastical organization, but rather the missionary aspirations. I dream, he said, of a missionary option, that is, a missionary impulse capable of transforming everything so that the church's customs, ways of doing things, times, schedules, and language and structures can be suitably channeled for the evangelization of today's world rather than for her self-preservation. Obviously, Francis's writings are meant to move the heart, chiefly. That's what makes them so interesting. And unlike previous popes, there's not a Minervian bone in the body. I mean, he does not want to stand at a distance from what he understands. You know, Leo wanted to stay at such a distance, he would not even bless Catholic political parties. It's the role of the owl of Minerva to understand what's true about reality, not just to advocate for it. That's unlike Francis. In fact, often Francis doesn't even adopt the mantle of speaking from or for any institution. So he says at the beginning, I'm almost done, Laudato Si, our goal is not to amass information or to satisfy curiosity, but rather to become painfully aware and to dare to turn to what is happening in our world, into our own personal suffering, and thus to discover what each of us can do about it. Unquote. He's not interested in what category, Aristotelian or otherwise, we should put the economic processes into. He wants us to understand them through suffering them. And so we take the three great institutions. Church, it's now a field hospital. There may be koinonia in a field hospital, but I've watched enough episodes of MASH to know it's a kind of funky one. In other words, so that for Francis, the ecclesiology has a strongly instrumental character to it. As for polity, they're subordinate. You should read his message to world movements about a year ago in the old synod hall in the Vatican. Movements, we need those, not the states, but their technocratic juridical frameworks. I don't know about marriage, but he definitely maintains family as one of the three great institutions, without doubt. So, what kind of world are we in? Well, we're in a world of activism, and in which the main things to be learned are things that we suffer. Unclear, two of the three institutions in Leo's toolbox. I'd say at least unclear. Well, we're going to need a field hospital, looks to me. I don't think from Leo's standpoint you can do without the priority, the fundamental priority of the three institutions of human eudaimonia. It may be left to human prudence how we're going to make them work together. You can't do without them. You can't instrumentalize two of the three and be understanding the same world. But I realize, as I say that, I'm speaking like Cassandra. It's time for me to stop.